Welcome to the Tasting Room live stream, December 27th. Merry Christmas to everyone that is watching this. Belated Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. Happy Hanukkah. Whatever it is that you
say. Happy New Year's.
Welcome back to America.
Yeah. Thank you.
Also, Happy New Year, because it's almost closer to that than it is Christmas here in a couple of days. You're a world traveler, sir.
Woo. Yeah.
We have a lot to get into, and we're going to save that for the back half of this podcast. We have a couple special guests that we're about to bring on, but quickly, where were you and why did you go?
So Lisa and I went to Paris, and we stayed in Paris, which is a kind of a unique trip for us because normally we bounce around. If we go to Europe, we'll go to Paris, then Munich, then wherever, and then fly back.
Yeah.
But this time we were only in Paris for about 12 days.
Okay.
Which was super cool. And we went because it was our baby moon.
The baby moon.
Yeah.
That's what I said last week when I had Mike Collier on, the chief meteorologist at KJRH. In the intro, I said you're on your baby moon. And then like for half the interview, I was in my mind thinking, is that the right terminology?
Yeah.
I think that's the right term.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the last two raw.
The last, right. Before life changes forever.
Forever.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what I should have done is hooked you up with our guest who I'm going to bring on right now. Because when you talk about France, you talk about wine.
True.
When you talk about wine, you talk about Flanagan Wines and Riley Rose, Eric Flanagan, right. Riley Flanagan. Thank you for coming on the live stream and the podcast. How are you guys?
We're great.
Hi, good. How are you, John?
I'm doing great. Where would you have told Austin and Lisa to go, like one place in Paris? What's your favorite place in Paris that they should have went to?
The river dinner that we did.
So Riley's talking about Alain Ducasse, who had his flagship restaurant at the Plaza Athénée for many years. Kit, my wife and I went there when we got engaged, which was exciting.
Oh, wow.
He closed that restaurant. He's now operating a Michelin-starred Ducasse sur Seine. So you get on the riverboat, and every seat on the boat has a fantastic view. If you're facing in, they have a full mirror, like the whole inside of the boat's a mirror. So everybody can see out, and they do world-class food with a tremendous wine list. And it's just a stunningly beautiful way. If you do it in the summer, you know, you leave the dock at like 7:30 or 8 at night and it's light out until 10 o'clock and you cruise up the Seine at sunset and then kind of come back as night falls.
And we got to see a ton of stuff.
You start right across from the Eiffel Tower and you go past the Ile de la Cité with Notre Dame and past all of the great, the Pont Neuf, Pont d'Alexandre. You go past every kind of famous site in along the Seine in Paris. And it's a really kind of a special, very high-end version of what the Bateau Mouche, which, you know, most people, if they've been to Paris, they probably did that. But that's fun. And the other thing that I love is just to go to the Jardin de Luxembourg. It's a very beautiful garden. It's there's a nice museum in the garden, lots of little cafes around the gardens, and it's a very, very large park. And that's a kind of a oasis in Paris for us. So
did you do either of those?
I did not, actually.
I should have hooked you guys up prior
to this. Mistake, you know?
Yeah, no, right. You're good. All right. We did a lot. We did a whole bunch. But actually, we were about to go to the Luxembourg Gardens. I can't remember why we didn't.
Yeah, something came up.
Something.
It always happens. Yeah. Eric, how long have you been in the wine business? What's your year count right now?
Depends how you figure it, but I bought the first piece of bare ground to plant the vineyards in 1999, and then Riley and I planted the first grapevine in 2001. We harvested our first grape in 2004. Our first commercial vintage was 2005, and the first wine we ever sold was in 2008. So, you know, you figure.
Pick a year, right? So we'll say in the ballpark of 25 years. I'm curious, when you
travel, because I know my whole lifetime.
Yeah,
I was going to say, exactly. That's why I asked Eric and not you, Riley, because you would have been like, my whole life. So, Eric, when you travel, like when you, because I know you go overseas a lot. You go to France, you go to Italy, you do all of that. Are you still learning things when you travel, or do you travel just for the experience?
Yeah, no.
Dad still learns things at home, too.
Well, that's just because you're the other, you know, the younger generation. You can teach him all sorts of things.
No, yeah. Well, I'm the old dog, but I guess I'm still learning a few new tricks, right? and it's fascinating to me. I traveled a lot. Last year, we took four couples from our wine club to the Loire Valley. That was fantastic. We stayed in a little town called Montu-sur-Cher, which is about 50 minutes east of Tours. So heart of the Loire Valley. Fantastic wines, not expensive. I love looking and doing kind of analysis on the math of vineyards. So like when you tell me what they get per bottle and what crop yields the French government allows them to have in Touraine, I can tell you what the land is worth, basically. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, wow. Oh, yeah.
Buy together. So I find that.
I didn't think about it that way, but yeah, that makes sense.
An acre of Grand Cru Burgundy could be $2.5 million or more. I think the top, very top Grand Cru sites are as much as $10 million an acre, $25 million a hectare. Yeah, top ground in Napa is around $1 million an acre, and that's the same as you get at the, for the best vineyards in Barolo, $2.5 million a hectare. Mm. So in the Loire Valley, by contrast, in Touraine, you can buy a hectare, 2.5 acres, of planted ground, very high quality Sauvignon Blanc that's in fully mature and functioning, but not too old, like in its prime of its life, sure. For 20,000 euros. 20,000 euros, that's $8,800 an acre.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Wow.
But that's because Sauvignon Blanc, Touraine Sauvignon Blanc doesn't sell for a very high price and the French government doesn't let them crop very high. That's the part of the rules of the appellation. And as a consequence, if you can't either get a very high price or get high crop yields, then you can't make a profit. And if you can't make a profit, the land isn't worth anything. And that's kind of inevitable.
Speaking of that wine varietal, Riley's Rose has one of my favorites. And I'm not just saying that because you're sitting here on the podcast. I do enjoy your Sauvignon Blanc. How's the Riley's Rose business? Because you just moved. You were here in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. Now you're back in California, a different part of California. Talk to me about the strategery, to use a Saturday night.
I just made that up. Cheers.
Yeah, right. But yeah, talk. Cheers to you guys as well. But yeah, talk to me about the strategy of and Eric, you can chime in here too, because I'm sure you had a part to play in that. But moving back to California, but to the southern part.
Yeah, I think he won't admit it, but I think he missed me. but when we started, it was interesting because Dad has been in this industry for so long, and I've always known I was going to follow him. But I think when I started my brand, my goal was to make wines that I wanted to share with people and that were accessible. But we didn't really know how to create a different brand model. So when we started my brand, we kind of mirrored it after his.
Yeah, so I had like 18 SKUs, right? Like AVA wines, vineyard designated wines, wines for restaurants.
And Riley was making different varietals than he was, but still making way too many different types of wines.
She had 8 different wines.
And kind of going from the standpoint of, if I love this and we can make a great wine, then I should do it. What I think I forgot to realize was I didn't have a career as a bond trader for 20 years before starting a wine brand. And I cannot just make every wine that I love.
Well, and you don't have a winery. Yep. And you don't have a tasting room.
And I don't have a wine club. Thanks.
So
it definitely,
you're going to be driven by wholesale.
I had to become a much more focused brand and figure out, where do I want to sell my wine? And where am I going to be able to be in a market where I can actually share wine with people and reach new customers? I think when I started my brand, I was really only selling based off of the connections that Dad already had and to the customers that he already had, which was a great place to start and something that I don't ever want to stop doing and something that I'm very grateful for. But my goal has always been to share wine with people. I love wine, and I want more people who maybe aren't wine drinkers initially to get into wine and ask questions about it and share it with their friends. And so that really then brought us to the whole wholesale conversation, being by the glass in restaurants and eventually being in retail shops, so that I can go out and meet people and not have to hand sell them every bottle, but say, oh, hey, go to this shop and buy my wine. Oh, hey, this retailer has my wine.
It's a completely different model where I'm making 18 different wines that are between, 200 or 100 and 500 cases per wine. She's going to make 2 wines or maybe 3 wines and make a couple of thousand cases of each and then grow that. And it's completely different where everybody who buys my wine, I pretty much know them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can do that if you're going to have a 5,000 case winery at a very high end and you have a place to host people. You have the tasting room and you have 1,200 people in your wine club. Then you can be a 5,000 case winery with more expensive wines, and you're not going to get rich, but you can maybe cover the costs and, pay people. It's not, you know, the wine business is not a place to get rich unless you're a very large company.
A rich in experience, but, yeah. And in franchise,
you know, make, you know, 50,000.
That's what I like to say about the craft beer industry.
Yeah.
Like, I have great friends and they always want to come to my house.
People are always happy when you show
because
up.
Because you have wine. Yeah.
You always got, of course. They're like, ooh, you bought wine.
I think, especially being in Tulsa and experiencing how open people were to me as a vintner, really helped my confidence, really got me ready and in a place where I felt comfortable being like, okay, I want to be a real brand and I want to be my own brand. I want to do my own thing. And I definitely needed to get my sea legs and figure out how to work in all the different facets of the industry. And so that was super helpful. We don't have enough of a presence in Southern California. I think a big part of growing my brand was being closer to the winery, making sure that I'm much more hands-on in expanding my production and making sure that my final blends are exactly what I want them to be and that they align with the wines that I love. And so definitely being able to be at the winery more often. Now I'm only an hour-long flight away and it's not connecting. So I don't have to worry about Tulsa thunderstorms derailing my blending sessions in the 7 hours.
Tornadoes, thunderstorms, random winds.
That takes a long time to get to and from Tulsa.
And also just being in Southern California, having the access to that market, I think is also really important. Yeah, and a Southern market California. We haven't really tapped into.
There are 27 million people between Santa Barbara and San Diego. It's basically like a medium-sized European country. Like, the truth is, if we got sufficiently focused in California, we could sell most of our or all of our wine here.
Yep, yeah, you can't say that because my Tulsa friends are going to get real mad at me if I tell them I'm not coming back.
We didn't sell any. And while we're on the topic of Tulsa, I do want to say that we can't be thankful enough or express enough gratitude to the people at Tulsa for the way they kind of really took Riley in. It was just remarkable. We just have always felt a great sense of community there, and we have so many friends there. But when Riley moved there, it kind of went next level, and the way everybody just kind of responded to her and took care of her was just awesome. Not that she needs taken care of.
Oh, no, 100%. Yeah. I am not a fully functioning independent
adult. She's not changing a tire.
I can't change a tire.
You're getting there, though.
Or even put air in the tire, let's just say.
I did try once.
I know, but then you let the air out instead of putting more
AAA
in.
Yeah, AAA asked me to stop calling, so thank God I had so many friends.
I've never known AAA to say, hey, we're going to screen your calls. Please, please stop.
I had them for my car 6 miles because the check engine light came on, and it turns out that it was just the battery needed to be replaced, which is not a towable offense. They also don't like it if you call just because the tire pressure is low.
They might drive to a gas station and fill the tire with air. Yeah. Yes.
And then when I tried to fill my tire and I drained the entire thing, that didn't go over that well.
I have to know how to fill a tire. This leads to one of my little funny jokes I like to tell people. When people say, like, what's the difference, you know? I grew up in New Jersey. Now we live in California. We spent a lot of time in Tulsa. And what's remarkable to me is that despite the fact that we all watch the same TV shows, we're all still so different. So different parts of the country really do have a different vibe, right? So, you know,
that's why I love to travel. Yeah.
Well, and I do this little riff, like, if you're in New Jersey and you lose your job, they're like, what are you, an idiot? You got 3 kids. You lost your job. You're a screw up. Like, you never do anything right. I can't even believe I'm friends with you because you're a disaster. Right. And then they make some phone calls. They call you back. They go, look, I got you an interview for 4 o'clock on Tuesday. Do not screw this up. I lied for you. I told them you were not an idiot and that you were marginally competent. Don't embarrass me.
Right.
In California, if I lost my job, they would be like, Eric, you know that our friendship is sacred. I you are so special to me and I care about you so much. However, I am like knee deep in season 5 of Naked and Afraid right now, and I do not have the emotional bandwidth to deal with your job situation. So, like, why don't you pursue your own thing? And if you don't have something by Valentine's Day, ping my PA and we'll have lunch. It's literally so California people, they act super nice. There are exceptions, of course, but that's like the cultural vibe, right? Act super nice, not do so much. Whereas in New Jersey, they're rude, but help you. Like I said to Riley, if you get a flat in California, don't bother to call anybody. They'll just tell you to call AAA. And you'd be like, right. Well, they're like four hours out. They're like, well, you know, do some, send some emails or something. You're fine.
You would probably say that to me.
I would come get you.
Send some emails or something. But that's very
familiar. You might as well send emails while you're waiting, but I would come get you. But like I always said to Riley in Tulsa, if she had a flat tire, there's 15 people she could call who'd be there in 10 minutes. Yeah, nobody's going to say, why don't you just wait for AAA?
Like, if I needed someone to get me out of a bad date, I think I had plenty of people who would go so far.
You have plenty of bad dates. That's,
Thank you. That's nice.
So you probably have some practice with that one.
We're not. I joked that we were going to talk about Riley's dating life. Riley, I'm not going to do that for you, so we won't go there.
That's what got Dad through COVID was the amusement of my dating.
Well, you know the rule. I'm sure you've seen The Princess Bride, you know? They say the first rule is never engage in a land war in Asia. And the second rule is never deal with a Sicilian when death is on the line. The third rule, which, by the way, I can actually do the role of the Sicilian sometime for you. But the third rule
I'll remind you of that later.
Yeah. Never go into COVID single. There's no possibility of hooking up.
Next time
there's a pandemic, just hit something super quick and tie that up.
That's fantastic.
Another thing I missed about COVID is I was in charge of all of our Zoom calls and we were on separate screens, so I could meet him all day long.
There you go.
Anytime.
That's power that you just voluntarily gave that.
I've never felt anything like that, Rach.
Yeah.
And you know what was fun for me was learning sign language. You know, that was really something that came out of that.
The middle finger sign language, like unmute me. Is that the one? Yeah. I want to put a pin in this because you said a couple things, Riley, that I want to come back to. But hearing you guys riff for the last little bit, it leads me, and you can jump in with questions anytime, Austin. Yeah. But it leads me to be curious on the working dynamic and relationship between a father and a daughter that obviously give each other shit and like – you know, you rib each other, you do whatever. Has it grown? Has it gotten better? Is it the same? Do you enjoy it? Is it frustrating? Like, what? Talk me through
all of the above.
Yeah.
It is funny because Dad is my best friend on the planet. And he's the person that I love and respect most in this world. Sorry to everybody else in our family, but, it is funny because I think we do clash a lot, especially as I am kind of gaining more confidence in my own role, in my own industry, in my own business. Like, we have definitely transitioned where at first I was completely reliant on you to set up any events and connecting with any email and really just trying to learn everything that I could. And now we definitely, we squabble a little bit more. I think I've looked at our average phone call is probably like an hour and 15 minutes.
Average? That's awesome.
There's certainly some of them that go that long. I would say certainly not the median call because we have a lot of shorter calls.
Yeah, but we probably spend at least 2 hours a day on the phone. And sometimes one day we spent 5.5 hours on the phone because we'll just sit on the phone and work, like, and send emails independently. And we'll hang up and call each other back. And often people will forget I'm there. But
it's like you're in the office, quote unquote, when you're in different places, right? You just leave the phone or when you're home.
Sure. Been here, John. You know the cottage is like 100 feet from the house. So.
Yeah. So is that Riley's office? Are you officing in the cottage? Is that
I live
when you're up there?
Following you from the cottage. Yeah.
Gotcha.
I think the one story that kind of captures our working dynamic perfectly is I was putting in an order for him and I had to send an email asking a question to a customer. I think I was just asking something about their order and like if they wanted to join the club, and there was a specific way that he wanted it worded. So he dictated the email to me and then I sent the email to him and I CC'd him. I sent it to the customer. He responded, perfect email. Next day, exact same situation with a different customer comes up, but exact same scenario. And he goes, yeah, this happened yesterday. Just take care of it. Absolutely. Send the exact same email with a different name and a different greeting that he had dictated the day before. And CC him on it. And he responds, this is a little wordy. It could be a little bit more to the point.
I'm very self-critical, to be honest.
You had time to sleep on it and think about it.
Yeah, I'm always trying to improve what I'm doing. But that's a funny story because I told her what to do and then I gave her shit for not doing it better.
And it's like, what the heck? This is your words. Yeah.
Kobayashi.
What are you guys drinking, by the way? You're drinking wine, but what are you drinking?
Yin-yang. Don't tell Kit.
No, she told me I could open it and just give the rest of it to her later. It's a 2021 Viognier. It's my wife's favorite. It's from a little.
Did you see how much of your wine I have behind me?
I do. Yeah.
You were here not long ago.
You either need to get a few more friends, John, or invite them over a little more often. I think that's the play for you. You know,
it's the latter. It's not the former. Yeah, my friend list is full at the moment, but
you do know most of people.
He's not accepting applications. He's like, closed for new membership.
Here's my problem. And there's a lot of problems. I'm not going to go there, but here's the problem with me and wine. It's that I open a bottle. So this is why I like bourbon.
It keeps
I can open it. I can pour an ounce, right? Mm-hmm. Put the lid back on. The ounce is good. I get to taste it and sip it and do whatever. But I mean, those bottle of wines are pretty big, you know? And so like, I know it'll like, I have like a vacuum thing or whatever. And
you don't even need that. But I mean, honestly,
the whole bottle.
Well, so first of all, yeah.
Right.
We're experiencing a lack of commitment from you, which is, you know, something to work on your end. You know, you could.
That's one of my blind spots. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of my blind spots, apparently.
And this came up to go back to the kind of the COVID era, like when we were sending 4 bottles of wine for each of our Zoom call tastings, there was sometimes one person on the Zoom link with 4 bottles of wine. They're like, I can't drink 4 bottles tonight. We're like, well, you don't have to. The truth is, if you had a glass out of 4 different bottles and you corked them all and stuck the wines in the fridge, the white wines and the red wines, not just the white wines, they'll keep for days. So you can have 1 bottle a day minus the glass you already drank for 4 days, and they'll keep in the fridge. Can I say this part? Oxidation is a chemical process. And like most chemical processes, possibly all, but I hate to be definitive when I'm not required to be.
Not all of them, but it's most of them.
Most of them. See, I had somebody argue with me who was like a chemistry major. They're like, you know, it's all of them.
There's like a couple reactions you have to run very low temperature, else they will not go.
Okay. So that's why I say most, because it's almost never.
I know why they were arguing. We're not going to get into it.
It's almost never.
I was a chem major.
Almost never a bad idea to avoid being definitive. Almost never. So anyway. I did.
That's a father-daughter tangent right there, by the way. That was a good one.
You put the red wines in the fridge, it slows down the rate at which they oxidize. They keep much longer. You put it on the counter, might go kind of plummy in 2 or 3 days. You put it in the fridge. I've had bottles of Pinot Noir with this much left in them that I left in the fridge. If it's like 34, 35 degrees, nothing really happens in there, or not much. And I've had to keep a week, 7, 8 days. So.
Okay, well, that's good to know, because
for long enough and it spends too much time, or sangria.
Yeah,
put it in a blender.
Always, you know,
triple sec, frozen fruit, make a frosé.
That's true. Yeah, so I had an experience at an airport on my trip just recently. I hate doing this, but had a wine that was, I guess, corked or whatever.
Yeah,
and it was. Terribly oxidized. How long do you think that sat behind the bar?
Anytime you talk about wine, there's like a vocabulary of it for wine people. So when you say corked, what that specifically means to a wine person, a sommelier or a winemaker, is that the bottle, the cork had a taint in it. In other words, when they cleaned the cork, they didn't get the chloride out of it. And it literally had a chemical reaction with the wine in the bottle, and it made it smell like wet newspaper. Yeah, like wet cardboard. It smells stinky. And that's a corked bottle. Now, if you had a bottle where the cork dried out, maybe the wine leaked, maybe it was sitting straight up instead of on its side. And so the cork didn't stay wet. And then the cork dried out and leaked and oxygen got in there. That would be an oxidized bottle.
Right.
And that would be a corked bottle.
If you're at an airport, what probably happened is that they just opened it. They let it sit out on the counter for a week.
Was it a by the glass wine or did you order a whole bottle?
It was by the glass.
So
by the
glass. It may have been that that bottle had been open for a couple of days. Was it a red wine or a white wine?
Red wine.
So they may not have put it in the fridge. They may have left it sitting on the counter because they want to serve it at room temperature, even though they should serve it a little cooler than that. They generally don't. They just leave them sitting on the back bar. And if nobody had ordered that wine in a little while, it could have either been that the bottle was off to begin with because the cork had allowed too much air in.
Or it got too hot.
And it was super plummy. There's a number of things.
Yeah.
Especially with airports, though, the way that they have to bring wine into the airport is so complicated. It could get left sitting outside on a 90-degree day for 4 hours and just cook in the bottle, literally. So it's challenging, but I'm sorry you had that.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's always an awkward thing because you can definitely see. I think it was an oxidized bottle of wine because you can definitely see you know, there's a little bit of that brown hue.
It gets brown. Yeah, that's an oxidized. Yep. That's an oxidized. Yeah, and yep. It gets plummy, kind of.
Yeah, and it was just flat. The flavor was flat, and then I asked for a new bottle, which is the most awkward thing to do in a restaurant because they probably are rolling their eyes like I don't know what I'm talking about. But the next glass was perfect.
See,
there's a difference. There's a difference.
And I think, I talk to people a lot about how to talk to sommeliers. And, you know, it just depends. If you're in a very good restaurant with a really knowledgeable sommelier, generally they're quite good about it. If you say, hey, would you do me a favor? Would you smell this wine? Or would you, if you still have some of that bottle, would you taste it? Mm-hmm. Because to me, it doesn't taste like I expected the wine to taste. And they're generally really good. And I'll go like, yeah, that's off. I'm so sorry. Let me get you a fresh glass. You know, the only time you have any trouble is when you have an undereducated person pretending to be the somm. Just like in any other field, right? When people don't know what they're doing, they get defensive, right? Because they're insecure. Yeah. I always say to Riley and her sisters, all bad behavior comes from fear, and insecurity is a form of fear. So people who really know what they're doing, if you're talking to an advanced sommelier or a master sommelier who has an encyclopedic knowledge of wine, they're not threatened by you. And if you say, hey, this doesn't taste like what I thought, they can try it and say, well, that's what this wine is supposed to taste like. I'm sorry you don't like it. Can I get you something else? Or they can say, hey, you're right. Great call. Good nose. And this one's off. Let me get you a fresh one. And so knowledgeable people are always, to me, great to work with. And I try to explain that. You know, I did a class during COVID, funny enough. Morgan Stanley had hired a class of young associates, and none of them had ever taken a client out to a dinner, like a business dinner. So they had me come on and talk to them. And because I ran a hedge fund, so I was a big client of Morgan Stanley back in the day, and also have the wine side. So I kind of understand what a client dinner is like, since I've been on like 500 of them. And I was the client.
You might know a thing or two.
Yeah,
I've been there and done that. And then also, I have the wine thing. So I said to him, look, when you go into a restaurant, don't pretend to know things you don't know, right? That's the first thing that gets you in trouble, right? If you don't have to know anything about wine to have success at the dinner. If you ask your customer, if you're entertaining a client, you say, hey, do you enjoy wine? And they say, yeah, I love wine. Well, do you like white wine, red wine? Do you like to start with white wine, have red wine later? What do you think? You know, they're like, well, I don't know. Why don't we get an appetizer and have a bottle of white wine? And then maybe like later, depending if we get steak or whatever, we'll have some red wine. Cool. So now you know kind of which direction. You say to the client, do you have a favorite kind of wine? They can say, well, I love California. I love Sonoma Coast Pinot. That's my favorite. Well, okay, that's a pretty clear direction, right? So then what you're meant to do is wave the sommelier over and kind of, you know, I would say, you know, give them a bracket of price points, right? You point to a $60 Chardonnay and an $80 Chardonnay and say, hey, we want to start with something white. I was thinking about like something like this or like this. And you can say it doesn't have to be a Chardonnay. You know, we're going to have like raw oysters for our appetizer. He goes, I got an Albarino that just came in. It's not expensive. I think it's fantastic. You're going to love it. Can I bring that? And you go, yes. And then they bring it. The customer thinks you're a genius. You're utilizing your resources. You're asking your customer questions. You're asking the sommelier questions. You're letting the person who's the expert in the topic make suggestions. You're following, you know, and you're communicating really well with everybody. You look like a genius. If you walk into the restaurant and you panic because you don't want to ask any questions because you're afraid of looking stupid, and you order like, no offense, but like La Crema or something that you get for $12.99 at the grocery store because that's the only one.
Not to call out any wine or any labels or anything.
Oh, am I not supposed to do that? Is that illegal?
No, you're good. You're good. Okay.
So anyway, you know, it's fine. It's just a grocery store wine. But like if you twitch and just order the thing that you recognize, you're going to disappoint your customer you've wasted the resource of the sommelier and you kind of got to fail. And
because the chances are you going there to dine didn't go through the however many months or years of studying it took to become a sommelier. So like, why
and
not?
And more particularly than that, even John, if I went into a restaurant where I know just as much as a sommelier does about wine, he still knows or she still knows more about their wine list than I do. They put it together.
Oh, sure, sure. Right? Yeah.
So they're the expert on their list. That's one of the kind of unfair things about the SOM exam is they have a hypothetically infinite list they could ask you about. If you were running an actual restaurant, you'd have a finite list and you'd have assembled it. So you'd know everything about it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and that's, that you just said a really great point for people, you know, that don't know how to order wine off of a menu or beer for that matter. That sommelier, that experience for them to give you a great suggestion that they're happy about is why they have that job.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Exactly. They want to do that.
Yeah.
They want to be that resource.
Take advantage of that. Yeah. And by the way, I do the same thing with the menu. I'm going to ask the server,
what's
the special? What do you really love? What's your favorite fish on the menu? He'd be like, oh, we just got in the Bodega Bay halibut. It's super fresh. It's fantastic.
Yes, halibut in Bodega?
Right out 40 minutes from here. Yeah. It's amazing. So I always ask questions. And you know, like the fancy restaurants love to do this. They love to put menu, like list things, ingredients that they have to have at least one thing in each dish that you don't know what it is.
Sure.
They do. Like they want you to not know. Yeah. And it's like, oh, ramps. Well, that's like a pickled fern or something, right?
How many things at Sushi by Scratch the other night did you not know?
We had no idea what he was talking about, literally. Yeah, there are 17 different ingredients in every small piece of fish. And you're like, how could you possibly fit all that stuff on that one little piece of fish? But
you weren't?
It was a good experience.
No, I was still in San Diego for that. I went to sushi the next night at one of our favorite sushi places on the planet.
Soichi.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
Super great spot in San Diego.
It was one of my best friend's birthdays. And so we went there.
It's an amazing restaurant.
They're great friends of ours. And they have some of the best sushi in the world. And it's the most relaxed environment.
It's like a 14-seat restaurant. There's like one table for four and 10 seats at the sushi bar or something. Cool. Maybe it's 16 seats. And the chefs are super talented and really engaging. So
you do have to share one glass out of every bottle you buy with the sushi chefs. So
which is part of what makes it so fun and exciting. You know, they are.
I respect that.
They're having a good time. They're really having a good time.
Yeah, that 6 a.m. flight the next day was not fun. Yeah, I slammed my hand in the door.
The flight was fine, I'm sure. The alarm to get up to go to the airport for said flight was the part.
Yeah, I could still taste the wine for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Eric, one question, and then I want to jump back to Riley for a second about what we were talking about earlier. With what you're saying about the sommelier and how you ask questions, do you treat maitre d's the same way at hotels when you travel? Do you utilize them for their knowledge of like the cities, or do you kind of know already?
Sorry, you mean a concierge? It's a maitre d' in the restaurant. Yeah, but concierge.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry, concierge. Yep, you're right.
Yes,
you're right.
Similar vibe. But yeah, so yes, although I tend to also ask friends who I think have been someplace or done something. Hotel concierges can really be helpful and they can get you reservations that you couldn't otherwise get for yourself. But I also, you know, I think that they tend to kind of maybe fall into a little bit of a routine and recommend the same five places to everybody. So I do utilize concierges, but I would also check with friends who've been there and get some inside scoop from them before I head there.
You know, I think we should check with concierges more because there are some that are a big part of our businesses that, you know, we work
locally.
With local
hotels locally.
And they have some great.
Yeah, they do refer people to us.
That they refer us
to the wine.
It is a maitre d'. Why did I say that? It's in the restaurant, but what is it?
Who decides if you get into the basically back in the day, you'd go up to the maitre d' at a fancy restaurant. You didn't have a reservation. You had a hot date. You screwed up and didn't make a reservation. You slipped the guy $50 and all of a sudden you get the window table. That was maitre
d'. Is it a fancy word for hostess or host?
Well, maître d'hôtel is maitre d' is what it means, but they would be running. They would be sort of overseeing the floor. They're the head of the front of house.
Gotcha.
In the restaurant.
Okay.
And so they decide who sits where, who gets seated when. If you're friends with the maitre d', you can show up, you know, at 10 o'clock at night and they're going to seat you.
I'm not sure we have many of those in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So
we're not that fancy.
I don't think you have any maitre d's.
We have general managers.
That is true.
I think maybe Darren needs to get a maitre d'. Do you think somebody to stand at the front
door? That would set Dr. Clark.
Excuse me. You know, do you have a reservation? And they're like, no. It's like, I'm sorry, it's 2 hours.
You know, the one place that I think actually did or does have one is Bull in the Alley.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. That's a great spot.
Is his name Scott?
Delta.
But that's their sommelier as well.
So we wear multiple hats in Oklahoma.
Yeah,
apparently.
Yeah. And I could be wrong on that, but
yeah.
You guys have a lot of great restaurants in Tulsa. You really do.
There's a good food scene here. Yeah.
It is funny being back in California after living in Tulsa for 2 years.
Are you hungry when you leave dinner?
Oh, I think the reason everyone in California is so skinny is because you can't afford to eat.
Oh, yeah.
A Caesar salad before you add chicken is $20. So we share
it. Good Lord.
We went to a pizza joint. We got one large pizza, which is not that large. It's not like an enormous pizza, but it's bigger than the small, which is tiny. So it's one small, one large, and a Caesar salad. Like no chicken on this. Just chopped romaine and some dressing, pretty much, right? It's $100. It's $100.
Nice.
$100.
I realized it was actually
mine. I hope it was great.
I didn't efficiently add the toppings.
Oh.
Artichoke hearts were $4 for my pizza. Riley did a lot of pizza.
She always adds avocado to make a new
one.
That's my item.
But it was $100 for a large pizza, small pizza, and a Caesar salad.
It has been funny being back in California because I grew up in California. I only lived in Tulsa for 2 years. But I now like wait for guys to open the door and I say y'all all the time and everyone's like, where are you from?
Literally stops and stands there looking at a door and I'm like, you're in California. No one's gonna open that for you. They're scared to open it for you. You're gonna call them a sexist, you know.
I can get my own door, thank you very much.
Who's assuming you're a man and I'm a man and she's a woman? Like you can't even assume that in California. There's no way of knowing.
True.
Everyone's like, you sound so Southern. I'm like, I never lived in the South. I'm like, I lived in Oklahoma for 2 years.
Which is more South, yeah.
They're like, you California. Speak so slowly. And I'm like, now I say you talk slowly. I'm like, oh, dear God. And
the door
all the time.
The door dance with, so Lisa, my wife, is from Chicago. The door dance when we started dating was quite interesting because I wanted to open up the door for her, and her response was, I can get it myself. And I was like, I'm just trying to be nice.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, why do you think I can't open
You know where it gets really hard, Austin, when there's a double door, and you open the first one, you get to the second one in time. There's no way without running them over. Now what do you do?
There's not.
We're opening the second one on them.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You reach over the top. And
the whole thing is very risky, Austin. The whole
John
thing
knows
is
how
risky.
To do it because he's an Oklahoma guy.
Yeah. you let them start to pull, and then by the time you get there, you reach over the top and you grab the side of the door. And
of course.
It's
a science.
It is a science.
I'm going to die.
Okay. So before I forget, let's jump back for a second, Riley, because I don't know how long ago now. You mentioned a couple things that I wanted to touch on. Oh, I remember both now. Awesome. Okay. So you were talking about your strategy for Riley's Rose doing the wholesale stuff and not the memberships and the tasting rooms and all that. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, is there a strategic plan down the line where if you do grow roots in Southern California and it becomes, you know, a good place for business that you want a tap room or not a tap room, but like a tasting room? Or are you good with wholesale? Okay.
And I remember we talked about this a lot when I first moved to Tulsa because I wanted my own storefront. I wanted my own spot. And I think I have too many friends in too many places at this point, which is a really good problem to have. Mm-hmm. But if I had a tasting room, I would want to be there every single day. I wouldn't want to tell you that it was a Riley's Rose tasting room or a Riley Flanagan place and not have me there. Pretty much all my events I'm at, actually all my events that I have ever That's posted about.
Something
I'm,
that distinguishes us.
Yeah, I'm there.
We never hired somebody
and
to do our events.
So I don't think I could do a tasting room the way I wanted to. And even if my brand does take off and does really well and I have the stability to actually do something like that, I don't know if I would want to because it would take me away from all of my different friends all over the place. And I want to be able to still travel around and do events everywhere. And I do a lot of different charity events all over the country. And it's really important to me to be able to keep doing that.
I would say like you keep an open mind about it.
Yeah.
It could be something you do 10 years from now.
You know, when you have
a big successful brand and you want to open like, and maybe you're only there one day a week, but you show up one day a week and that's the day.
Or maybe I finally meet somebody who wants to run a tasting room and we can make it a family venture. Ruby has a ginger heart and wants to run
like
a tasting
retired,
room.
I'm like retired and I just go there and harass all your guests. Like, you know.
I'm not sure about that one.
You know?
But maybe Ruby one day decides she wants to be in the wine industry and wants to
Eric would be a great maitre d' at a tasting room.
Yes.
He'd be a great hostess. If there is a Flanagan that one day wants to run a Riley's Rose tasting tasting room. Don't say that. But you're not old enough to get away with saying whatever you want yet. But if there was a Flanagan that wanted to run a tasting room, I would be super happy to have my own spot one day.
Sure.
But for now, I'm very happy to be running around the country, hanging out with my friends and doing different style events. Because I've done a bunch of different things. I've done brunches. Done seminars. Everything. I've done girls' nights. It's really fun.
Yeah.
I think one of the coolest
things. Yeah, I did a boat wine dinner.
It was a wine dinner on a pontoon boat.
That was fun.
I was going to talk about the Legends of Golf thing because I think that's really cool.
That's fun.
It's been really fun. And working with Nancy.
Do you know about this?
Absolutely incredible.
So Austin is a former college golfer. So he's like a legit golfer. So go ahead and soft pitch him on the Legends of Golf thing. Yeah.
So Dad got connected with this company, Legends of Golf, a couple years ago. And they originally approached him about doing a collaboration with Nancy Lopez. Their whole thing is that they take a famous golfer and a winery from their country, and they collaborate and make a wine, and they sell it in duty-free stores internationally.
So some examples, like Jose Mari Olazabal does a Rioja, and Constantino Roca does a Chianti, and like that. So they find, you know, Bernard Langer is doing a Riesling. So they find a famous golfer, and then there'll be a wine region that that golfer has an affinity for, usually from their country. And then they pair them with a vintner, and they do a special wine. So they came to me, I said, don't do it with me, do it with Riley, it'll be way
better.
And
so we worked with Nancy Lopez, and it's actually funny because she went to TU for a while. She was there for a year.
Did you guys know that?
I didn't. Yeah,
she was That's a Tulsa cool. University student for a minute. But she came out here and she gave me a golf lesson. I like to think I gave her a little bit of a wine lesson.
You did.
Or at least a drinking lesson.
A vineyard lesson, a barrel haul lesson.
And so we went through the vineyards. We went through the barrel haul. We barrel sampled a couple of things. We just plain old drank wine together for a while and went through the different nuances of why she liked what she liked. And we found that we actually have not similar styles, but there were like some overlap in our palates. I like a more fruit forward, clean, less oak, a little bit more flirty Chardonnay. And she and I definitely agreed on that. She's not big into the oak. She's definitely more of like a fruit forward, little
lighter style.
She loves Sauvignon Blanc. And
the two of them are freaking hilarious.
We had so much fun together. We almost crashed a golf cart. Which I'm like, Nancy, you're supposed to be a professional here.
My favorite.
She walks when she plays, though.
Well, there was 3 days.
That's why she's still in such good shape.
They shot 3 days of video of Riley and Nancy, and they were just so charming together. But one of the really fun things was they started Riley about 6 feet from the hole, and they wanted her to putt the ball into the hole. Well, after about 20 attempts, none of which were really legitimately close.
I cartwheeled a lot too.
They moved it to about 4 feet, right? And from 4 feet, Riley also consistently missed by a fairly good margin. But on like the 40th try from 4 feet, she sank the putt finally. And I want you to know that the celebration between Riley and Nancy in that moment was as real as could be. Like, everyone's like, oh, thank God. And they're like,
well, it's been 4 hours at that point. So it's great.
Like, did you get it?
You made the putt.
Did you get it? Yeah. Right. Yes, we got it.
Like,
oh my God.
Because we're not going to get another one. Right. Yeah.
I golf for the vibe. I love
that. Was your one. There you go.
Yeah.
No dates at putt putt, I assume.
Well,
we did a lot of putt putt when she's growing
up. And when I was in high school, we went to the mini golf place. They don't love me there. I thought
you were actually banned from.
I hit a ball into the freeway.
That's pretty intense to be banned from a putt-putt golf course.
Wait, did you just say you hit a ball into the freeway?
I don't know why somebody would build a mini golf place right next to a freeway. That feels
How hard did you swing?
I was not in the best mood at the time.
A little bit too hard.
As it turns out, I can hit the ball hard. Not when I'm trying to, but I don't think I'll ever go on a date at a mini golf place.
The driving range was a whole experience, honestly.
Nancy kept telling me to hold the golf club like a baseball bat. And I was like, Nancy, how many baseball bats do you think I've held?
Right.
Yeah.
That's fair.
All right. Let me ask you one more question, Riley. And then Eric, I have one for you. And then we'll let you guys go because it's been 45 minutes. And I know you got things to do with the league. It's only 6:45 where you're at. And Eric, you can chime in on this question too, because it's kind of for both of you. But Riley, you mentioned that you started with, was it 8 different varietals of wine and then pared it down.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, and Eric, I don't know how you chose to make the wine that you made, but like, or that you sell now, but how did you pare that down, Riley? Yeah. And what goes into that decision-making? Well, is it strictly business
When I initially chose my wines, it was because of stuff that Dad didn't make that were wines that I loved. So Sauvignon Blanc, easy, really fun. Semillon, Rosé, which we got in a whole fight about, which is a story for another time.
Red blend,
which is a Syrah Merlot Cab blend, which you don't do. You did a couple times, but haven't in years.
Right.
And then when it came to really figuring out what wines I was going to focus on, it was about looking at the plan for my brand. And I want to be able to
feedback from the market.
Absolutely.
Like distributors said, the Sauvignon Blanc is money. We can sell that. And if
even
you
can respond to the rosé,
and
really
it's scalable.
Well. But that's what I was going to say is I want to build my brand, but I don't want to compromise my price point or the quality of my wine. So if I'm going to make 1,000 cases or if I'm going to make 10,000 cases, I want it to still be the same wine, which maybe seems a little naive, but with the Sauvignon Blanc, we can do. Dad owns that site. This is a time that nepotism does come into play, and I'm very grateful for that. Because while he doesn't give me a deal on the fruit, he still charges me full price. He would, I think, if I came to him and said, I want to make more, he would find a way to make sure that I had access
to have enough
fruit.
Sauvignon Blanc vineyards that she could make 10,000 cases of Sauvignon Blanc. It would taste exactly the 1,000 cases of Sauvignon Blanc she made 2 years ago or the 1,400 she made last year.
So let me ask you this, Eric, while you just said that, hold on, before I forget. So you have that many Sauvignon Blanc vines and grapes and acres, but you don't make Sauvignon Blanc. So why do you?
There's a lot of demand for that grape variety. And so it's financially reasonable. You make money farming Sauvignon Blanc right now.
And I think the majority of the fruit that you farm, you don't make into wine.
We sell a lot of fruit from the different vineyards that we own.
Okay, and then we buy
from vineyards we don't own. So that's kind of that happens a lot here in Sonoma County and the whole North Coast. I buy a little bit of grapes from Kent Ritchie and from the Bacigalupi family and from the original ranch where Riley and I planted the first vine. We buy Syrah from there. And then we sell a bunch of fruit to other neighbors, you know, and that's very normal because we all want to make a bunch of different wines and we don't all grow every different grape variety or have each different kind of site that we'd like to display. So for me, the answer, for my answer to your question, how do you decide what wines to make? For me, it was always driven by how do I make something unique and distinctive that I love? So I never started from like a marketing thing. And this is the difference. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have a 5,000 case brand that'll never make any money. And I make 18 different wines. And I love all the wines I make. And I'm sourcing great fruit from the top vineyard sites for that grape variety. So they're all amazing. But it's all super expensive to do. And I don't make any money. But that's that. Riley can do a really, really good job making really delicious wines at a better price point. It's more accessible to people. And is more reproducible. Like if I have 20 acres of Sauvignon Blanc, that'd do 160 tons of Sauvignon Blanc. And that's enough to make, 10,000 cases of SB. So no problem. And it'd be exactly the same as the 1,400 cases she made last year. So her idea is to maintain her quality and keep the integrity of her wine consistent and also protect the price point so it's still an accessible wine for people. I'm not thinking about that. I'm making amazing wines and charging like what I think a fair price for them is. And we could get into a 2-hour discussion about how to price wine, which we've talked about before.
That's next time. Yep.
It has something to do with what the grapes cost and everything else costs and something to do with what people are willing to pay for it because of the quality of the wine. So it's a balance between cost and quality and marketing and your client list. If you have no clients, you can't sell wine. It doesn't matter how good it is. So there's a lot of different factors that go into it. But
that's true in any business. If you don't have clients, you can't sell whatever it is that you're making.
But you get people that buy a new vineyard in Napa and they want $700 a bottle for their Cabernet that no one ever heard of before. And they get like a famous consulting winemaker. And I'm like, why do I care about your $700 bottle of wine? There's 400 people like you making a $700 bottle of wine and they kind of pretty much all taste the same. So I don't really care. I'm much more interested in people who are really engaged and finding great sources like the Vignier. That's a great example. That's one we're drinking. I didn't make a Viognier because we were going to make money making Viognier, or because there was a giant market demand for Viognier. I was like, this is the vineyard produces my favorite Viognier in California. I love it. And now that the fruit's available, I can buy it and I can make my favorite Viognier in California. And I love that. I love making the best Viognier in California. And my wife loves it too. And that might occasionally redound
to win-win. Yeah.
Just saying.
So good. Subtly.
It's a win-win.
Wasn't that subtle? That was good.
I thought that was You're so subtle. Better. For You're me, that better. Was really subtle.
It plays dividends in both areas.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. See, Austin is picking up when I'm laying down there.
Yes, Daddy.
Yeah, I think we're all picking up what you're laying down.
I think we're there. We're on the same wavelength there. Before I let you go, Eric, go ahead. Go ahead.
Finish. The good news is Kit will definitely not watch this, so I'm fine.
Fair. I was going to have you explain what t-shirt you're wearing. Go ahead and show everyone the t-shirt. You're
such a good friend, John.
Where's that uncle?
Where's that uncle?
Well, I think you said it best, John. I think it's a dialogue that transformed mindless fear into thoughtful courage. And that's a quote from you.
Is it?
That's a quote from John. I may have paid him to say that, but I may have paid him to say it.
He's therapy.
But, it was really fun and kind of an exploration of running a small business during COVID and some of the frustrations around that and sort of making a request for rationality and courage rather than mindless fear and panic.
And he's on Spotify.
Yeah.
Eric Flanagan or Larry's dead uncle. And if you listen more than once a week to the entire album, you will be his new top listener.
There we go.
Besides me. And also at larrysdeaduncle.com.
You might not know this, Riley, but we're going on and I say we because I'm going to be the videographer. We're going on an international tour. Was it Finland?
Finland is definitely going to happen.
Lovely. Yeah.
He's big in Finland.
Yeah. Try and get an importer.
Big listening in Finland. Big listenership in Finland. And
I understand the words I'm saying, which is probably helpful.
Well, you already translated one song into French. You can translate one into whatever they speak in Finland.
I did. We went to the Loire Valley and I met all these French guys. So I re-recorded one of my songs in French just for fun.
Did a birdie tell me there's a movie coming?
Well, I think maybe there is. I think we're taking the 9 episodes we did of the show and whacking it down into like a super cool movie that's just got a lot of there's some just priceless moments in it. The thing that was so special about it is we just had the best characters between Marco and Kyle and Kit, who constantly tells me I'm idiotic, and
Ryan, really,
who's always trying to help me but thinks I'm probably slightly crazy also. It's a really funny cast of characters. And I do, in the movie, we joke about it, that we created a whole new genre of recording movies with no scripts. Because honestly, if you're asking people to remember lines and say things they wouldn't say as themselves, it's going to come across kind of fake. There's nothing fake about this. It's completely real and it's all actual conversations and it's freaking hilarious.
Okay. And they can find that out for themselves.
Another level.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's fantastic. All right. I'm going to let you guys go. It's almost dinner time. Riley, give me your socials, your website, and then Eric, I'm going to ask you the same.
Thanks for coming on, Instagram, guys.
Thanks for having us. Instagram is Riley Flanagan or Riley's Rose, and website is rileysrose.com. So we make it easy. Okay.
Perfect. And I'm Eric490 on Instagram. And we do have a Flanagan Wines page too. And that links also to the Facebook page. And then I'm also on LinkedIn, just under my name, Eric Flanagan. So,
awesome. FlanaganWines.com, right?
FlanaganWines.com is our website, 100%.
Perfect. Well, I appreciate you guys doing this. Hopefully, I will see your faces again soon. I don't know when that will be, but
you can always come to San Diego.
I think we were in Tulsa 2 weeks ago, so I think it's on you to come out here this time.
Okay, you twisted my arm. Dang it. Okay, I'll come to California. I'll stop in San Diego and then come up to wine country. We'll do that.
Sounds good, y'all.
Awesome.
All right, guys. Enjoy your dinner. Thank you for coming on. Appreciate you.
Okay. Thanks, Austin. All right. See you guys.
See you. Thank you. So that is Eric and Riley Flanagan. Fantastic conversation. Really, really, really good wine. Both brands. Good. Riley's Rose, Flanagan Wines. Fantastic.
Can we take these out now?
Yeah, we can take that out. That was hurting my ear.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's just because I had one in.
I think it's
I don't know what was going on right there. Yeah. But it was like hurting the cartilage in my ear.
I think it's because when you don't have both sides hurting,
maybe
you're more
you feel it more.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk. It's a random segue. Let's talk about your trip.
Oh goodness, what do you want to know?
Why were you? So you told me there was a story.
Yeah,
and why you were basically stopped from coming back to the country.
Well, not coming back to the country.
Oh, okay.
Going to.
Oh, is that? Oh, okay.
Going
okay.
To.
I missed that.
Yeah. No. yeah. Going to Paris was quite the ordeal because so we arrive.
If you forget your passport, that's what happens.
Well, we didn't forget our passport. We brought both of our passports. We arrive at Tulsa International Airport, the appropriate, you know, hour and 45 minutes ahead of time. You know, Tulsa, that's like 4 hours ahead of time. Yes. Anywhere else. Yes. We get to the booth, which we're checking in. I check in, everything's smooth, bag on the thing, they're weighing it, all green lights. They swipe Lisa's passport. No go. Not allowed into Paris. And or not allowed on the airplane. And they scan it again. We're like, that's fine.
Was she on the watch list or something?
We didn't know at this point. I was like, happening? Did her identity get stolen? Yeah. What's going on? Well, so the new, I think, I don't know, but this, I guess it's new or maybe it's not, but we learned this at the booth that Paris or France has, you have to have a passport that has it's good for at least 3 months before you return.
Okay. In case you just don't return.
In case you don't return. Yeah. And Lisa's passport was expiring in January, which to us was like, hey,
let's get the trip in.
Let's get the trip in, blah, blah, blah. Well, so we aren't allowed on the airplane. We call a passport place in Arkansas that night, get a reservation for same day passport, drive 4.5 hours. Ooh, that night
to Little Rock.
Is that where you had to go? Hot Springs, to Hot Springs, Arkansas, middle of nowhere. And then, okay, so we stay the night at a random hotel, get to the passport place. It wasn't entirely too busy, but there was like, let's call 30 people in line. We had a time reservation, and they were saying, we were kind of worried because they were overbooked, but they told us, hey, we go by priority of your flights. You will get your passport before your flight. And we're in Hot Springs, Arkansas. You know,
that's where I was born.
Really?
Yep.
Random.
The one and only.
I knew I felt
Oakland Park.
I felt great.
Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Yeah.
DeLuca's Pizza. I would have told you to eat there.
Which one?
DeLuca's.
DeLuca. We went to
Portnoy, rated it like 8.2 or 3, which on his scale is like
that's stupid high.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wish I would have known that. We went to Deadhead.
I haven't been there.
Pizza.
I haven't been there. Was it good?
Yeah. It was great.
Not part of the story, though. Continue.
No, I mean, I guess we spent the whole day in Hot Springs waiting on the passport to be processed and printed. So
what's that? Why do you have to go? What's that process? You go, do you have to retake the picture?
So we went to Walgreens, retook the picture, took the picture, did the paperwork and whatnot. It helps that her passport wasn't expired because we didn't have to have like her birth certificate and social security and marriage certificate and all this, that, and the other. So we did all the paperwork properly. And the reason that it was Hot Springs was because technically Dallas has a same day.
I was going to say, Dallas did at DFW airport or something.
Yeah. But so we got our flight shifted 2 days. And thankfully, the gal, I think it was because Lisa's pregnant and she was very sad for us, she shifted it for free.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So our trip literally shifted 2 days.
Then you had to go and change hotel reservations and change.
I mean, we didn't have to change. We kept our hotel reservation in Paris and then just added 2 days to it. We lost the 2 days, but Dallas, why we didn't go to Dallas was because Dallas didn't have actual reservations. It was first come, first serve.
Gotcha.
And we needed a passport that day.
Yeah.
So we went to Hot Springs passport office.
Did you connect out of Dallas?
No.
Okay.
No, we flew out of Tulsa and connected in Atlanta.
Atlanta. Gotcha.
Which, if you can avoid Atlanta.
Yeah, I usually connect. So the times I've gone overseas that direction, I've either connected Dallas and then Dallas direct or Boston, Tulsa to Dallas to Boston to wherever I was going.
Yeah, I would suggest anything but Atlanta. Like connect to Dallas, connect to Chicago, connect to New York, connect to Boston. If you can avoid Atlanta, do it at all costs.
Hartsfield International Airport.
Yeah. Because we flew back through Atlanta.
That 13th Colony Rye Whiskey is from the Atlanta area.
No,
it's just outside of Atlanta.
That's a great whiskey.
Nothing to do with what you're talking about. But I just caught it out of the corner of my eye.
So going there was about
that was the problem.
48-hour process. But we did it. It was actually less stressful than the story is, other than we had to drive 4.5 hours at night, wait nervously while the passport was getting printed.
So you went the night before, stayed the night, got up early, went.
Yeah. And then drove home, stayed the night, got on the flight the next morning, and voila, we were in Paris.
Voila.
Voila.
How was that flight?
To Paris?
Yeah.
Great.
Back
was great, too.
Not too long?
So
going, what was it, about 10 hours?
Ish? 9.5.
Yeah.
Almost 10 hours in
the
air.
That's a long time in the air.
It's a long time. And it was
the... Did you splurge for business class?
No. That'll be later.
Okay.
Great. Yeah.
You have a kid and you're paying for three.
Right. Yeah. Well, that'll be when we're paying for just two and the kid can be in your lap.
Gotcha.
Yeah. That'll be the business class.
I've heard, and not to squirrel us off, but I'm doing a lot of planning for 2024. And one of the things, I'm doing some financial planning and like goal setting and that sort of stuff. One of the things I've heard and I'm adopting now, any flight over 4 hours, pay for business class or whatever that equivalent of business class is, depending on what you fly.
I can tell you this. It definitely could have been worth it for the flight back.
Yeah. Because you're tired and you're going against the wind. And it's
an extra 2 hours.
Yeah.
It's awful.
So it was only 7 and change to get over there?
7 and change to get over.
That's not as bad as I thought it would be.
Yeah. It was like 7.5.
Direct into Paris from Atlanta?
Direct. Yep. Coming back was 9.5.
Yeah, that's rough.
And we were on a 777 old school, not the Airbus.
So you didn't get the extended leg room or anything like
that? Oh, it was... I'm still...
Yeah.
Suffering.
I saw that stretch just a minute ago. Yeah. How are you jet lag wise?
Right now I'm doing okay.
I mean, what's your body telling you right now? Are you supposed to be in bed?
Oh yeah. Okay. Where it would be.
Well, not what it would be there, but like to your, like, did your body ever adjust?
Yeah. Oh, in Paris?
Yeah.
In Paris it adjusts. Usually you get over jet lag if you do it right within a couple of days.
Okay. So you're still hitting it then.
But your body doesn't necessarily truly get over jet lag, like the one-way jet lag, like in 14 days.
14 days?
Something like that.
You just feel a little tired, a little off.
I mean, you feel fine, like normal after a couple of days. But to really get into the circadian rhythm is, I think, somewhere right around that 14-day, 17-day range. So then you're coming back before the 14 days, so your body is just all screwed up.
Yeah.
So, right now I'm doing okay because we arrived at we got our in bed at 1 a.m. So yeah, I'm surprised I'm functioning normal.
Me too.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah.
So give me a highlight, a low light, something you would recommend and something you would not recommend from your trip.
Okay. Highlight would be we got to go to the Musée d'Orsay. We went to quite a few museums. So the Musée d'Orsay is the Impressionist. So
I was making sure we were live.
Yeah,
sorry.
No, continue. No, you're good. Yeah. That's let's see. So that would be the Impressionist Museum, which is both Lisa and I's favorite art. But they had a Van Gogh exhibit.
Oh.
And it was the first of its kind. It was the first time that his last 74 paintings of his last 70 days alive have been in one exhibit since they think that they were saying since his death.
Wow. Was he the one that went a little crazy?
Yeah, he shot himself.
Yeah.
And the
but chest. His paintings went crazy too, right? Like he got real like weird.
Oh, yeah.
With his paintings the last like few years of his life.
Correct.
So that would be a cool exhibit to see.
It was awesome.
That sounds very dark of me to say.
No.
I don't
no.
mean it that way. But well, like
you can definitely watch like
the progression of like,
yeah. Well, the progression is
mental instability.
Well, like, he checked himself in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but you can definitely see he has like super happy days and then super dark days, super happy days, super dark days. And then they have
it's Dolly. Never mind.
They have his or they
had his book behind me.
Oh, yeah. They had his obviously last painting there, which he painted on the same day he shot himself.
What was that painting?
It was of some trees and roots and
okay.
I have a picture of it. But it looks like his brain went because everything else has like continuity.
That's crazy, dude. Cause if you think about that, that's a timestamp.
It was almost
of someone who hours later took his own life.
Right. It was, like everything
that's
else
insane.
Had a continuity to it, like incredible beauty and this, that, and the other. And then that one was like, did not make sense. You could stand in the corner.
Was it darker? Did you get a vibe from it that it was just like off?
Psychotic.
Okay.
Is the best. You could stand in the corner of the room, look at the 30, let's call it 20 paintings in the room that were, you know, let's say the last 20 paintings, and every other one, you know, he might have had a dark moment, lots of really bright colors and this, that, and the other, which would be his happy day. And then that one, you could point at it from 40 yards away and say, yep, that's the one where his brain just went. Yeah, it was.
And there was no like mental health facilities back then. So,
well, I mean, technically, he was in a sane asylum. So,
weren't focused on like improving the mental health of people. It was like wasn't like a societal thing like it is now, where you're like,
no,
are you okay? Like, are you?
Yeah,
you know, it was more like crazy. Go to this hospital,
right?
Yeah,
I think that they really kind of they were.
I mean, maybe I'm misspeaking.
I think that they were. I just don't think that they knew how to do it correctly.
Fair. And do you feel like there's probably more of an emphasis on it now than there was then?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, like psychology and psychiatry and this, that, and the other didn't really come into cultural normal language to be able to say like, oh, I'm seeing a psychiatrist or whatever since COVID.
True. When was his
interest?
Do you remember the year of his last painting off the top of your head?
Oh goodness. 1890.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
I
would hope we've advanced in that department.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Well, I mean, we've got antidepressants. We've got, you know, medicine that would definitely helped him.
Have you seen a therapist?
Have I seen a therapist? Yes.
Yeah. It's one of the best things. I recommend it. Even if you think you were totally fine. And you don't need a therapist. That means you need a therapist.
Yeah.
Just like it's the best money you can spend. Like it's fantastic.
It's super healing, super great.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's kind of an interesting question. I grew up with my dad was a psychiatrist.
I was going to say,
I helped run a facility with psychiatrists.
But I didn't know. I meant more like, do you as a patient go somewhere where like it's not?
I would definitely go to a different office. Yeah. Not that I couldn't. Go to our office.
Sure, but that would be weird.
It might be a little weird.
Yeah, I'm your technical, not boss, but like kind of boss.
Yeah, I don't think that would be fine. Be
They'd be like, "Oh, you're totally fine, Austin. Yeah, nothing to work on."
So, and I would be like, "That's totally not right." Yeah,
I can tell you, that's not
I'm
right.
too weird of a person for you to say that to.
Okay, so that's highlight. What's the low light? What was something that disappointed you? Maybe a restaurant you thought would be better, a dish, a view, a drink, something.
Like sure.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, we did the trip pretty right. I know that's kind of arrogant to say.
No, it's not.
Something that I just don't know if I would erase anything out of the trip, which is cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. Just make sure your passport's not going to expire within 3 months.
Right. I would probably erase that part of it.
Cool. But did that shift allow you to do anything or hit a reservation or something that you wouldn't have? It did, actually.
Yeah. Because we got to spend Christmas in Paris.
So it was worth it.
It was totally worth it. It was kind of meant to be.
Because you don't have a kid at home right now.
That's true.
So,
And
this time next year, it'll be first Christmas for a baby.
That's true.
Yeah.
So,
God, that's crazy to think about.
Oh, that is really weird. It's not weird, but it is crazy.
I mean, it's kind of not weird, but yeah.
Yeah.
Surreal.
Surreal. Like, there we go. I wouldn't even necessarily erase that because one, great life lesson. Two, did get to spend Christmas in Paris.
And you got to see Hot Springs, Arkansas.
That's true.
Had I known you were
there, actually, that's cool.
I would have sent you to my family's barbecue restaurant.
Ah, that would have been cool.
But you didn't tell me you were going.
Also, we only had like 4 hours in Hot
Springs. I guess it's my family's former barbecue restaurant. They sold it, but
whatever. But we went to the bathhouses and
did stuff. You do the bathhouse brewery?
We did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's decent cool. beer.
Yeah. Really good. I was kind of scared that it was going to have a lot of sulfur in it.
Tastes like a bathhouse.
I mean, it does. So I ordered an IPA, thinking that it would be better. And I really wish I would have like ordered a Kolsch or something, but
yeah, fair.
Whatever. I'm struggling to think of a truly negative thing.
That's fine. We'll move on from that. We'll just
So
a recommendation you would make from this trip would be to do or see or stay or eat or whatever.
Recommendation, a couple of recommendations. If you're going to Paris and you're staying for an entire week or 2 weeks just in Paris, find yourself a really good hotel close to a main trading station. And I would actually recommend Gare de Lyon, the train station that we stayed at or close by. One, it's really close to a really cool, hip neighborhood that no tourists go to. Parisians would probably hate me for recommending that. But two, that train station is perfect to go into town. You can get to almost anything in 30 minutes. And then it's a perfect train station to align yourself with to do a day trip. So like if you wanted to go to a chateau or Bordeaux or something outside of Paris, it's the train station that you would take everything.
Did they do underground or overground?
It's metro.
Okay.
Every above, under.
Thinking bus. Like, are there views like if you're going out of town?
Oh, all the trains out of town have views.
Okay.
Those are above ground. All the metro in Paris's underground,
like subways and
So that would be like, align yourself to think about, like, don't pick a hotel that's right next to the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, why would you do that?
One, you're gonna overpay.
Well, and here's my travel style, which is different from yours because you stay in a hotel. I do Airbnbs or VRBOs or whatever because I want to embed myself in a neighborhood. So now, like, my ears perked when you said that about that neighborhood.
Yeah.
Because now if I go to Paris, I will try to find an Airbnb or VRBO or something in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
And just become a local.
Like, yeah.
I don't want the touristy, even if I've never been to Paris, which I haven't. I don't want, like, yes, I will go to the Eiffel Tower and see it and be like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
But like,
and I would recommend that too.
Yeah.
Normally, Lisa and I would get an Airbnb.
Yeah.
She's pregnant. We wanted a very predictable,
yes,
comfortable bed.
No stress. No.
We wanted a pool so that she could, you know, if she was sore and she swam.
What if you would have had the baby?
That would have been 2 months early. So that would have been wild. But I guess they would have had dual citizenship.
How cool would that have been?
That would have been cool.
You should go back.
That would have been cool. So that would be mine. So normally we would do an Airbnb.
Yeah. So we do travel the same way. But
yeah,
I guess I forgot the whole reason for the trip was the baby moon.
Yeah.
So.
But align yourself. Don't overpay to be in the middle of town. You're going to see the Eiffel Tower. You're going to see the Arc de Triomphe. You're going to see these places. Don't pay the extra $200 or $300 to be right next door to it. And lo and behold, when you're right next door to it, your connections to everything else, like the metro, the everything else, gets so much more complicated.
Yeah.
If you only have like 3 or 4 days, you absolutely have to do the Louvre, do the Musée d'Orsay, and then do the L'Orangerie.
Okay.
Those are three museums.
Well, that's big over there. I mean, that's what Paris is known for.
Yeah.
That and croissants.
Croissant, like, yeah.
Was that the best croissant you've ever had in your life?
Every single one that I had was the best one that I ever had. Like, it was.
I'm so jealous.
It was so good. I love
a good croissant.
Yeah. It was in Pain au Chocolat.
Oh, yeah. The chocolate croissant.
Yeah. Chocolate. I mean, come on. Had those every single morning.
Cappuccino or some lattes.
A cafe.
A lot.
A lot. Yeah. It was awesome.
I need to get over there.
You do need to get. You would fit really well.
I was listening to you while you were talking, but I was also thinking, God, this is such a I'm self-deprecating myself with this statement. I was thinking, like, I have clothes that would fit in Paris.
You would fit very well.
Like, I could do this.
You
and,
could like, do
not have to, like...
What you're wearing right now would fit very well in Paris.
And I have a coat hanging in there that's, like, a perfect Paris coat. Mm-hmm. Totally need to do that.
So,
did you try to go see a Paris Saint-Germain football match while you were there?
No.
I mean, sure, Lisa wouldn't want to go pregnant.
No.
Did the thought cross your mind?
Not even a little bit.
No.
I mean, she's too much into art. So we hit
I didn't even think about that. That makes perfect sense why you did all the museums.
Yeah.
Because she's an artist.
So she knew all the names of even the small ones. And so we hit up everything. One of the more surprising museums that we hit up, which was super cool, two of them, was the Rodin Museum, which was super, super unique. So Rodin, which you might not know that name, but he's the...
I feel like I've heard of it, but I don't.
You have. You probably have actually seen his statues. Okay. So he's a... help me out here.
A sculptor?
Sculptor.
Okay.
My brain is...
I don't know if you're saying sculptures of him or he made.
He makes sculptures. Sorry, my brain is firing at half speed.
You're okay. It's 2 a.m. your time.
Yeah.
On your body.
But he's deemed the best sculptor since Michelangelo.
Oh, shit.
But his museum is the hotel that he bought in life. And then everything inside of it is he donated the hotel or his house to the state and set it up and donated all of his personal art to the state and set it up before he died.
Wow.
So it's literally curated by him, and it's all his stuff, and the artwork in it he owned.
That's cool.
So that was one of the cooler, like, surprise moments.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And obviously Lisa was like, well, we need to go to the Rodin Museum. And I was like, who's Rodin? And she's like, well, have you ever seen the statue, The Thinker? So that would be
I
one.
Have. Yeah.
Yep. That's
Did you
him.
See that in person?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
cool.
But the
that statue's ever like that meme is everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
It's the most known statue on
Did
Earth.
Did it tell you who he's like, who was that?
I don't know.
Did it tell you that? Like,
no.
Okay.
It didn't.
Like who the person was that was the person, the thinker.
You know? No. He usually sculpted his friends, which would make sense. Mm-hmm. But and the thinker is actually a part of a larger sculpture that he worked on for 31 years.
Oh, damn.
It's like the what is it called? Shoot, the gates to hell or.
Oh, I've heard of that or what?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a lot of his statues or sculptures are that we know of are incorporated into those doors,
bigger pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that piece he worked on his whole entire life up until the day he died. Literally the day he died, he was working on it.
That's dedication.
Yeah. And that's that the final sculpture is in the d'Orsay. Musée d'Orsay.
Gotcha.
And the thinker is in the Musée d'Orsay.
Oh, is it? Okay.
But the casting, the cool thing about sculpture and the way he was doing it is you can cast multiples. So also the thinker that he casted is also at the Rodin Museum.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's a little tidbit.
I love it.
Yeah.
How long did you spend there?
12 days.
Okay.
13 days? 12 days.
Would you recommend less that amount or more?
I mean, man, you could honestly live in Paris.
Assuming money is...
Money's not an option. Yeah. 12 days was... So for Lisa and I, we have a high stamina for a lot of information and museums. If you're not into museums, you're going to have a good and very fun time. Yeah, 4 days
yeah.
to a week. If you love museums, you could spend 3 weeks to 4 weeks in
sure.
Paris.
Sure.
'Cause, so the Pompidou Museum, which is the post-impressionism, so 1920s and on. So the oldest painting in there is... that would be Picasso.
Oh, yeah. That's
or the Bauhaus movements, the Still, S-T-I-J-L-H, Still movement. I don't speak German.
Nope,
I'm with you. But like that era, like we spent 5 hours in that museum and there's two floors and we only spent time in one floor.
Jesus.
And that's not a museum that people would normally go to, but a lot of art in there they have seen either in books or magazines or this, that, and the other. Andy Warhol is in there, which is, you know,
that's cool.
Painter that slashed
yeah.
paint slashed the paint everywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could, if you're not into art, I wouldn't recommend Paris, but
no,
because
there's not enough.
It's romantic.
Croissants.
I mean, it's romantic. Yeah, I mean, spend your nights in cafes and mm-hmm. brasseries and
yeah,
all that. Which that was interesting. So the brasserie or brasserie, which is what we all see in the movies, mm-hmm. the cafe.
Moulin Rouge or yeah. no?
Moulin Rouge is...
That's more of like a nightclub.
Right? Nightclub.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what they called a brasserie or not.
No. So brasserie is really what you see in the movies, like people drinking coffee and this, that, and the other.
I was way off.
No. Okay. But so the word brasserie is brewery. Huh. And they all started as craft breweries in the 19th century. And then... became cafes after yeah. that because it was that. It was fashionable in like the 19th century to brew your beer. It's actually started by the German immigrants, brew the beer, sell sauerkraut in the same place.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you were telling me they're like 20 to 30 years behind our craft beer renaissance here yeah. in the States.
Yeah. It was
so I'm trying weird. To think of what like 2000 to 1995 ish was like in the craft beer scene, and not much.
A lot of Belgian beer.
Okay.
So,
which is right up your alley.
Right up my alley. I was in heaven because every bar had like a triple on or a single, and saisons and this, that, and the other. So that was cool.
Yeah.
And they were serving him in Imperial pints.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. So 22 ounce pours of triple.
No wonder you enjoyed that trip.
It was so great.
Much. I'm surprised you remember that much of that trip.
Well, I mean, I was with a pregnant gal. So
she's your DD.
Well, that's true. My
your designated Uber caller or whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we didn't have to worry about that. We were taking the Metro.
Fair.
Yeah.
Man, that sounds like a fun trip.
It was awesome. Yeah. One of the best surprises, I guess, that we had. So after all of the museums and whatnot, you're inundated with all of this historical information. So, you know, you're pumped with... This happened at this year. Louis the 14th did this. Louis the 16th did this. Marie Antoinette got her head lopped off here at this date. Blah, blah, blah. The revolution, this, that, this, that, and the other. Well, we go out to this chateau. Oh, man, I'm going to have to look it up. But we go out to the chateau in the middle of nowhere. It's about an hour and a half outside of Paris. And for the locals, I would basically say for the locals, because not every American is going to be flying to Christmas for the chateau.
Also true. Yeah.
They decorated the chateau, which was the chateau that the Versailles was built around.
Ooh.
So it's incredibly huge and beautiful.
Yeah.
Just out in the middle of nowhere. But they decorated the inside all in Christmas.
That's cool.
And it was not about the history. Obviously, if you went there during the summer or whatnot, it would be about the history. But this time, nothing historical. It was just about Christmas. And all the fireplaces that you see... in like all these old palaces and castles mm-hmm. that you don't think that don't work. They were all lit.
They work.
They work.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they had it
being
all
being a chimney sweep in that part of the world is good business.
Yeah. And they had hot wine and hot chocolate. And,
hot wine.
Yeah.
Like mulled wine.
Mulled wine. Yeah. And we roasted marshmallows out there and in the gardens. And
how cool is that?
Yeah, it was super cool. And they,
did you know it was going to be that way before you went, or did you go for the history?
Okay. No. We went out there because we heard that they were doing, and then they had a Christmas light show that was, projected up on the chateau.
That's cool.
Like a 3D light show. That was super rad.
How did you guys learn about that? That they were doing that stuff.
Lisa, I don't know.
Who knows?
She just found out that they did that.
Because the concierge/maitre d' conversation we had with Eric and Riley, my the way I, so I don't utilize, well, I don't stay at hotels. If I can help it, I'll stay in Airbnb.
We don't really,
but like, the first day I get somewhere, like that happy hour-ish night, I go to a well-known, like, popular bar.
Yeah.
And I make friends with the bartender. And I'm like, hey, yep, you're my dude or dudette.
Where am I going?
Exactly. And yeah, I didn't know if maybe you guys the first night heard about this place or something, or if it was something she researched and knew.
Yeah. I think it was by a recommendation through probably Instagram, honestly.
Sure, sure.
Or, you know, some sort of, hey, this advertisement or whatever.
You know what I appreciate about you guys? There wasn't a bunch of social media spam about your trip either.
Nope.
I just realized that. Yeah. Like, if I wouldn't have known through friendship that you were there, I don't think anything was posted.
I don't think there was.
I mean, you don't post to your own account, so I know you didn't do it. But I don't think anything was posted to her account either that you were out of the country.
And
maybe that was for safety reasons, to let people know that your house wasn't
maybe
vacant, or I don't know, but like
I think that's kind of a choice of ours when we're on, we just don't, we're so inundated with social media and whatnot.
I respect that
during our life. So
100%.
Yeah. You'll probably see more photos.
Should. Well, that was the point. It's like, I didn't even see you like half of this stuff that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Should we start to wrap? We've been 90 minutes now.
Yeah.
It's been there. Shout out to Prudence, by the way.
Yeah.
She got a little antsy.
She did. They're like,
I don't know if you guys could hear it, but you could see it. She would bring me one of her little toys over there on the ground. Hey, Prudence. Prue, come here.
Come here. She might not even come over.
She's asleep, but she's going to come now. I got to give you your props. You did very good tonight. You picked a toy that wasn't squeaky. And you kind of listened when I kicked you out of the frame for the most part. So thank you. I appreciate that.
She did great.
She did good. And Charlie just slept the whole time.
Yeah. Well, so that's him.
Kudos to them. Kudos to you for your trip.
Yeah. Thanks.
Welcome back. Monday.
Monday.
8 p.m. There you go. We'll see you guys Monday on the Tasting Room live stream. That will be January 2nd.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
January 2nd. Whew. First one of 2024.
Let's go.
Hey-o.
I'm ready to be out of 2023.
Who knows what we're going to talk about? Who knows if we'll have a guest? We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out.
All right.
We'll have fun.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
See you guys next week.
See you.